This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we bring you interviews recorded at Sun and Fun 2019. You'll hear about the Aerospace Center of Excellence, a family-owned GA aircraft interiors company, how a high school student funds his pilot training, a flight operations software company, and a competitive glider pilot. In the news, we look at 737 MAX fallout for American Airlines and Boeing, a pilot rescued by a hazardous tree removal company, unexplained aerial phenomena seen by military pilots, and a human transplant kidney delivered by drone. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 551 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. I'm warning everybody early in advance, there will be a lot of coughing in this episode for some reason. But I also would like to give a shout out. I have some book reviews coming because I've got three books that arrived this week, one on Tomcats and two from our friend of the show, Jamie Dotson. So
cool.
I got some reading to do. So I'm looking forward to cracking open paper books.
They still make those, don't they?
They do.
Yeah, that's good. I'm especially excited to hear your thoughts on those books. And also with us is another Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's also the 2008 CFI of the Year. And if you're interested in learning how to fly a Cirrus aircraft or buy a Cirrus aircraft, well, Max Trescott is the guy for you. Hey, Trescott, how are you?
Trescott. That's what people used to always call me in college. I don't know. I guess one of my roommates called me that.
Trescott hey. Or Trisket?
No, that was in elementary school. Yeah, I just got back from flying one 2017 that somebody has. So getting somebody checked out, and it's always fun to introduce people to really, really, really nice airplanes. Now, David has been reading and I've been writing. This has been day four of a binge. So if I start to go crazy here, it's because I've been sitting in front of this computer for too many hours.
Yeah, it's not healthy. You gotta get up every now and then. You know, walk
it's
around.
It's true.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me.
It also real. I learned today I was doing something at work, and I had to do a lot of handwriting, and boy, my handwriting went from atrocious to downright unreadable. Because it's like, wait a minute, how do you make this letter in cursive with a pen? Clearly, typing has taken over everything.
Yeah, that's a different muscle group, I think, when you have to handwrite. Oh boy. All right. Well, those of you who are new to the show, welcome. Also, we typically have a guest each episode, an industry guest. This episode, we don't. We're going to take a break from the guests this time. And instead, we have some interviews that were recorded during this year's Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida. So we'll have those coming up. Some interesting folks we talked to. And we'll be sharing those with you. But first off, we'll start with some of the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready as I'll ever be.
CNBC says American Airlines trims outlook, citing 737 MAX groundings, but expects planes to fly again by mid-August. Yeah, by mid-August, they say they'll have their 737 MAX jets flying again. Also, they say that a combination of, well, higher fuel prices, but also the grounding of their 24 737 MAX aircraft have pushed the airline to cut its 2019 earnings forecast. I guess that's not a huge surprise.
no, gas prices are going up. And that's kind of what caught my attention on this article. They said their guidance for 2019 is that their fuel bill is going to be $650 million higher than I thought it was going to be. And I guess that's going to be a little bit of a hit. And of course, grounding all those jets has been a little bit of a hit. I know there have been a lot of canceled flights. Even so, they're still saying they're going to make a bunch of money and profit should be somewhere between $4 and $6 a share. That strikes me as a pretty wide range. I mean, usually people come in a lot closer to what the guidance is going to be. So I guess there's still a fair amount of uncertainty for them out there. But you know, when you really think about what the whole industry has gone through, this is remarkably tragic and has reverberated in so many ways throughout the industry. To lose 300 people in two crashes is tragic. And you know, now we're starting to see all the financial impacts, not just for the airlines, but for Boeing as well.
That's right. Boeing just had its earnings call last week. And they made some interesting statements. One is that they've added $1 billion to the 737 MAX program to cover costs expected to this point. So there's more to come. I think a couple of weeks ago, I maybe tossed out a number of around $2 billion was my estimate of what it's going to cost Boeing for this, but it might be a little bit low. But they've also decided that, but they being Boeing, have decided that they will not be giving earnings forecasts going forward for this year. That's kind of an unusual move. I'm not totally in tune to what happens on these analyst calls, but it feels like that's kind of an unusual thing to do. But I can see that.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty abounding here. I got a question for you, Max. You may know more about this. Certainly, I know almost nothing about it. Are there guarantees that Boeing makes to the airlines when they sell them aircraft, where if the aircraft become unavailable for long periods of time, like the 737 MAX grounding, where Boeing then owes money to the airlines for the loss of revenue for the grounding?
Yeah, typically there is. And there's really two components to it that it's useful to think about. One is, what's the guarantee? And that's something that's negotiated. And that may be different for different customers. That could be based on the relationship that Boeing has, or Airbus, the airframer has with the customer, with the airline. Or it could be based on other considerations. But that's the guarantee. The other part of it is, what's the remedy, right? You can guarantee certain fuel economy. You can guarantee certain dispatch rates. You can guarantee all kinds of things. It's easy to have a guarantee, but what really counts in the end is, what's the remedy that's negotiated? And sometimes those are negotiated fairly creatively. You're never going to know who's got what deal. That's just never made public. So what Boeing has to provide to the airlines for compensation for their losses in this regard is, you know, something that we won't know. Of course, Boeing will be sharpening their pencils. Their lawyers will be taking a very close look at the contracts to see what's in those contracts. But in any event, it's going to be a lot. Also, sometimes you'll see some negotiations. For example, some airlines that are talking about or have canceled 737 MAX orders may want to do that because their situation has changed, wholly apart from the accidents and what's happened. But their situation may change to the point where the economics of that aircraft in those quantities may not be as financially attractive to the airline as they were when the deal was struck. So there may be some negotiation, some compensation, some relief in terms of canceling orders. So the whole thing could get very complex, and it will very likely vary airline to airline. Tough to be Boeing these days. We also see, and I think this just came out today, but the FAA hit Boeing with a new airworthiness directive. And unrelated, seemingly, as of June 3rd, the AD requires inspections and checks for aileron and elevator power control units. There have been reports to the FAA, apparently, about hydraulic leakage caused by, yet this, lightning strikes, of all things. So that's another Boeing-related news item. Each day there's something new, it seems.
Well, yeah, and those hydraulic leaks apparently are in the control units that power the ailerons and the elevator. So it's not exactly an area where you want to lose control authority after a lightning strike. And my guess is that the leaks are pretty darn slow, but they must have found some, which is why they had this AD. You know, the other thing that I just saw today, and I didn't read the whole article, but it was a mention that Southwest Airlines is for the first time looking at Airbus. And of course, they have been a 737 only fleet for their, what, I guess it's over 40 years of existence now. Now, to some extent, I wonder, you know, are they just using Airbus as a foil at this point to improve the negotiations with Boeing, or are they indeed serious? And I guess the answer is it could be a little of both.
Yeah, I agree. And Mary Kirby and I talked about this on this week's PaxX podcast, which actually we probably spent two-thirds of the episode talking about Boeing. Actually, those of you listen to this show, don't listen to the PaxX podcast, may want to check that out, because we had a conversation that was kind of relevant to these topics. But yeah, John Ostrower wrote a really nice piece in Air Currents talking about this issue. And as I mentioned on the PaxX podcast, he did a really good job sort of explaining the historic relationship between Southwest and Boeing, a very close relationship, kind of a symbiotic relationship in many ways. But as we all know, Southwest has been an all 737 fleet and you know, a strong Boeing supporter. And so now there are these indicators that maybe they're looking at the A220. And, you know, yeah, why is that? Maybe it's a negotiating tactic. Maybe Southwest would really be interested in providing that aircraft for some of its routes, for some of its customers. Of course, the A220 is very popular with travelers because of the comfort levels in that airplane. So, yeah, that'd be very, very interesting to see what comes of that.
Yeah, and it's going to be very expensive for them to bring on a new aircraft. And so they want to buy certainly probably a minimum of 30 or 40 of them at least to justify all the, you know, kinds of work they would have to do from, you know, setting up of spares and training of maintenance folks and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There are huge efficiencies to be gained by a single fleet when you start to introduce other aircraft and, yeah, training and ground support equipment, just the logistics of managing another fleet that's different than the one you've got. This add a lot of costs. Very curious. I think a lot of people are watching that to see what happens. Well, moving on, we have an article in AvWeb, pilot rescued from treetop. We talked about a GA plane previously that had become entangled in wires, power lines, and so forth in a residential area. This was a case of a Piper Cub that ended up, what, about 60 feet up in the air and in the top of this tree.
This is truly remarkable. This is not the first time an airplane has ended up in a tree, but probably it's one of the most dramatic pictures and one of the higher, you know, treeings of an airplane. This thing is really up there, extremely high. And it was a 79-year-old pilot, and you kind of wonder, okay, you know, maybe he, you know, was coming into land and, you know, was a little low and didn't really realize, you know, that he was that low. Happened around 9 o'clock at night, apparently. So, you know, maybe it was nighttime and he just, you know, didn't realize that he was below the glide slope coming in. But I was intrigued by how they rescued him. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is imagine yourself stuck in an airplane on the top of a tree. How do you get down?
Yeah, you don't want to move.
Exactly.
You don't want that plane to fall.
Yeah, I mean, you're lucky to have survived a crash. You're in good shape, and you don't want to ruin your good luck, which, you know, falling from 60 feet, you know, that could be fatal. So they called a tree expert who climbed up the top of the tree, and as he did, he limbed the tree on his way up. So he was removing limbs as he climbed to the top of the tree. Then they secured the plane with webbing to the treetop so the airplane didn't fall out. And then he put the pilot in a harness and took him down to the ground. So pretty remarkable process. The thing that cracked me up the most was in an article here in which the tree surgeon said that he felt that it was just another day at work climbing and limbing a tree. Yeah. So yeah,
it's just like getting a kitten down, right? You know, the kitten climbs up the tree, and you bring the fire department with the snorkel, and you just get the cat, and everything's happy go lucky.
Yeah,
they get the airplane out of the tree?
You know, they didn't.
They didn't say that part, did they? They did say that they were originally, or at least initially, thinking about bringing in a helicopter to get him out of there, but they thought the downwash from the helicopter might blow the airplane out of the tree. So they wrote in this tree expert. Another thing this article mentions, it says the spot locator beacon was activated, and that alerted the International Emergency Response Coordination Center, the IERCC. What's a spot locator beacon?
Sure. Spot is a product that's been out for probably 8 or 9 years now. It uses not the Iridium satellite system, but the other one, NAV something or another. And essentially, it's a small portable device which allows you to send and receive very short pre-recorded text messages. And it's got an SOS button. And when you hit the SOS button, it sends a message through whichever satellite happens to be overhead. And these are low Earth orbit satellites, so they're relatively close, so the power levels don't have to be, you know, that high. And then it's relayed to a center, which, as I recall, for this system is down in Texas. And they've got people who staff that phone 24/7. And when they get a signal, they can tell with GPS coordinates exactly where that signal came from. And then they'll contact local authorities to come out and find out what the problem is.
Hmm. And does every airplane have one of these?
No, Spot is a kind of a personal device that a pilot would buy. I think originally they were perhaps around $150. They may be down to around $100 now. There is a service that you can buy that provides tracking so family and friends can look on the internet and see .. you know, your breadcrumbs, where it is you have flown. And then you can also send and receive some limited number of messages. But I think the real basic service, which you may not even have to pay for, is to push the SOS button. That happens so rarely that they provide that part of the service for free.
Take a look at the AvWeb article. We'll have the link, of course, in the show notes. And just the way this plane is perched up there in the treetop is pretty amusing. I think it could have gone really bad, really easily. Probably if he'd been, you know, a few feet off in either direction, might not have, he might have tumbled right down to the ground.
And you know, this airplane is probably not much bigger than a typical RC airplane. No, I'm kidding. It's a little bit bigger than that. But the relationship here is
not much heavier.
No, that's true. The relationship is the same as for drones. I have learned flying RC planes that trees have a magnetic attraction for RC aircraft and drones. And apparently that's what happened here.
Yeah.
You didn't learn that when you were a kid with kites?
kites or model rockets.
Or anything with a parachute. Talk about the 82nd Airborne and D-Day.
Speaking of crazy things, it seems like, I don't know, the crazy things come out of Philadelphia. It seems this is from Philly.com.
Yeah, ha, ha, ha.
Frustrated pilots got Navy to stop dismissing UFO sightings. So the military calls them unexplained aerial phenomena. But the rest of us call them UFOs. And apparently more of these are being spotted in not just by average people. Military pilots are repeatedly seeing something. And so now the U.S. Navy has drafted procedures for the pilots to use so that they can document these encounters. I don't know, David. What do you think they're seeing?
unidentified flying objects. Just exactly what it is. Now, the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines and the Army have been dealing with UFOs since post-World War II, and in fact, during World War II. In World War II, there were these small balls of light that B-17 pilots and fighter pilots saw that eventually became a very famous rock group. That would be Foo Fighters. But after the Air Force closed the Project Blue Book in the late 60s, early 70s, it was discouraged to report anything you see. And that goes for not just the military, but civilians. You didn't see what you saw. Military pilots and people like Max Truscott are really good observers. They're used to seeing things in the sky. They understand what they're seeing. Now, if it's 14,000 feet and something whizzes by them, they're immediately going to say it's a DJI Phantom.
Yeah.
But if you are observing, if you are a trained F-18 pilot, and this is where this started about 3 years ago when this footage got released of an object that was doing things that would outperform any U.S. vehicle, you need to be able to record that and you need to be able to counteract it. So the Navy is now saying, okay, well, it may not be little green men, but we don't know what China, Russia are up to. And I've also added Tyler Ridway's article to this that he published over the weekend, which talks about things like the Navy not knowing what the Air Force is doing, things that fly out of Area 51. So it's okay to report something you don't understand what you saw. And they'll analyze it. Is it little green men? Is it aliens? I don't know. Is it conspiracy theories? I don't know. I've been dealing with UFOs since college, since I taught the Temple University class on UFOs and American society with David Jacobs. Being told that what you saw, you didn't see, is a terrible thing, you know, and pilots are a really good resource. Law enforcement are really good resources. So the Navy is going back and saying, okay, if we see super technology, we're not saying it's aliens, but yes, you guys need to report it because we need to figure out what's going on because we need to protect our ships and our bases and our aircraft, you know, and our skies. That was one of the reasons why they created Project Grudge and Project Blue Book. Project Grudge was because there were things being reported that seemed to be a gross threat to the United States. Eventually, it became Project Blue Book, and we all know the Project Blue Book was designed mostly to dismiss everything that was being reported, and things like SR-71s and U-2s use that kind of cover for plausible deniability upwards through the F-117. You know, it's easy to tell somebody, oh, well, that was just a UFO. It was a black diamond, you know, and when actually it was one of our aircraft. So interesting universe, you know. Right now, like Max and I talk about on a regular basis, if it's unidentified, current default is it's a drone. But there are things that have been unidentified and never ID'd, and the Navy's acknowledging that they need to keep a record of those phenomena.
Yeah, there's a quote here from a spokesman for the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Information Warfare, who told the Washington Post, quote, since 2014, these intrusions have been happening on a regular basis. We want to get to the bottom of this. We need to determine who's doing it, where it's coming from, and what their intent is. We need to try to find ways to prevent it from happening again. So, I mean, that on the face of it is kind of an admission that there's something happening. And yeah, I think it's a good point, David, that to this point, probably a number of pilots have been likely reluctant to report this for you know, fear of being criticized or ridiculed or
retribution.
Or retribution, even worse. So, Max West, have you ever seen a UFO flying around up there in your Cirrus?
No, I haven't really seen anything that gave me any pause for concern. But, you know, I think there are things that people see that may have perfectly good explanations. We just can't figure it out at the time. So, yeah, I think keeping track of this stuff is a good idea. And who knows, maybe they will eventually figure out, oh, my gosh, it's a good thing we did because we discovered that and XYZ, whatever that might be.
Yeah. We also have from AIN Online, drone delivers kidney for successful human transplant. And this is a GE Aviation unit that collaborated with the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, as well as the Living Legacy Foundation of Maryland. And they flew a human kidney in a drone 2.6 miles. This was on a University of Maryland Medical Center drone and a 10-minute flight. And they apparently were successful, and I guess someone is happy to be alive with this replacement kidney.
I was fortunate enough to see the CNN interview with the physician who led the transplant team.
Ooh.
And he thinks that the future of transplants are drones, and was very, very clear that this was cheaper, safer, more effective way to get that kidney from one patient to another without damaging the kidney, without losing life, without having speed involved, because you only have a short time before you can get from one patient to another.
This GE unit is, you know, I can never pronounce things with X's in them. It's AIRXOS. How do you say that?
Axos.
Well, there's an R in there, too.
Aircross.
Aircross. Oh, maybe it's Aircross.
Aircross.
Well, somebody listening to this probably knows, so let us know. I think that we should strike the X from the language altogether because it's too confusing, at least to me. Anyway, they...
Welcome to the Matt and Matt co-hosts here.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
Let's not strike all the X's.
Well, I feel pretty stupid now. All right, well, anyway.
Oh, with all the X's, all I can say is, oh.
Oh, yes, okay. It's an air mobility platform. And this is for unmanned traffic management applications, operations, and services. And they're involved in, one of David's favorite programs from the DOT, the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration Pilot Program.
I hate that.
Because there's no pilots involved. Yeah, it's kind of ironic. But there are, as we talk about on the UAV Digest, there are 10 of those pilot programs, and this GE Aviation unit was selected to partner for three of them. But this is another great application, and we do see, David, we do see a lot of sort of medical applications in some of these early delivery by drone programs.
That seems to be where the drones are going. What the doctor who said on CNN was, I didn't know, but previously most kidney transplants and transplants are done by helicopter. And evidently a couple of years ago, there was a the helicopter died. So the two pilots, the two paramedic crew that were aboard the helicopter and the patient died because the helicopter crashed in transit with the kidney. So that is a catastrophic loss of life, whereas if you just lose the drone, you lose the drone and the kidney, and you might be able to save the patient, and you're not losing four other people. So that was a very telling statement. But as I said on UAV Digest, drugs are optimal. They need to be delivered with time and speed, and usually they're not very big. And we're seeing that in Africa, that they're doing a lot of blood samples and delivery of medication because it fits the profile. And we're not dealing with large boxes and such. yet, but we're delivering something that needs speed, something that's small and reasonable weight to be delivered. And of course, this was completely, it was flown with a big team to make sure it got there on time, but it's a huge success.
I really like it. I think this is just a fantastic match with technology and with the application. You know, first of all, it's high value. It's something where the cost involved in, you know, shipping a kidney can be relatively high simply because, you know, there's a lot of money involved. And you contrast that with something like delivering pizzas where it's like, geez, you know, how much money can you save delivering a $20 pizza via drone? And, you know, just from a societal standpoint, yeah, I think there's a lot more value to, you know, transplants and just keeping people alive than, you know, saving them 5 minutes on getting their pizza. But also from a weather standpoint, you know, we have lots of times where we may have fog, for example, 200-foot overcast, where it would be incredibly dangerous to even consider flying a helicopter. And yet, if it's fog, it's fairly stable air mass, and so there's no problem with sending the drone through it. Now, obviously, there are other times when you have 200-foot overcast when there's a storm going through and a drone won't be able to fly in high winds. But yeah, I think this is just an absolutely perfect match with the technology and the application.
We have some interviews that we recorded at this year's Sun and Fun in Florida, where we had a great time. Max Trescott was there, myself, many other friends and listeners and fans. And it was just a great opportunity to talk to some really, really interesting people. And we'll kick this off with a conversation I had with Ed Young. Now, he's the executive director of the Aerospace Center of Excellence. And this is something that, well, it's much larger than I knew going down to Sun and Fun for the first time, where I kind of tended to view it as just, you know, an air show. Well, yeah, it's much larger than that. The Aerospace Center for Excellence is 17 acres. It's a campus, really. And so here's Ed Young and myself having a conversation about all the activities that they have going on down there. I've taken refuge here at the museum at Sun and Fun. It's kind of nice to come in from outside from time to time. And I'm with Ed Young. Ed is the executive director, Aerospace Center for Excellence. And Ed, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, I appreciate it. My friends speak highly, especially Peter Miller speaks highly of the podcast and how great it is.
Yeah, Peter told me that I had to come see you, and so I've done that. Now, one of the things that people have been explaining to me here at Sun and Fun is that this is a lot more than just 1 week in the year, and everybody goes home and comes back a year later. There's a lot of activities, a lot of things that are going on throughout the year. So, Ed, tell us a little bit about what those things are.
Sure. The Aerospace Center for Excellence is actually the 17 acres at the south side of the Sun and Fun Expo, and it includes the Central Florida Aerospace High School. It also includes the Bueller Restoration Center, the Piedmont Hangar, the Aerospace Discovery at the Florida Air Museum, which is where we're sitting right now, and the Crossfield Building, which contains an A&P course that's presented by Travis College.
That's a lot. How did this come to be? Did this evolve over time?
It really did. The founders of Sun and Fun decided that they needed to missionize the air show. So the air show has become our biggest fundraiser for all of the other activities that we do here, which is inspiring people to pursue careers in aviation. And we've actually adopted the mission here that we engage, educate, and accelerate the next generation of aviation professionals.
And do you have any measures of success?
We actually have quite a few measures of success. We've actually put wings on 91 teenage pilots, which the concept in and of itself, makes insurance people a little bit nervous. But we've done that. We also have the Lakeland Aero Club, which has flown student pilots. Well, they're actually not student pilots. They're private pilots, but have flown them to Oshkosh every year for the last 8 years. We also have a number of A&Ps, 26 A&Ps, that we've helped get their A&P licenses. And We've actually had 30,000 student engagements so far this year.
Just this year.
Just this year. We had over 15,000 just in January. We actually slowed down a little before the air show because we only have 26 employees, and there's actually only five of us that work regularly in the education program, so we knew we had to slow down a little bit. We'll have a significant number of engagements this year. We'll probably break the old record, which was 50,000 last year.
I was going to ask you about the staffing because it sounds like an awful lot of work. Do you have volunteers as well?
Well, so for the air show is when we hit our peak with volunteers. We, like I said, we have 26 full-time staff, and then we have 3,500 volunteers. And so there are volunteers running everywhere, and frequently you don't even know or recognize the volunteers, and they're doing pretty critical work. So we put a lot of trust in those people who come out here and give themselves to us for usually around two to three weeks. We also have a number of early birds, which are folks who arrive in January, and then we have yearly birds that live on the campus throughout the year. So they live on the campus for free for doing 24 hours of volunteer work. So we have a lot of volunteers. We have five in the educational area that are pretty regular volunteers. Mostly they work here on the campus doing student tours and so forth. But then we do have a SWAT team, which is mostly college students who deploy to the elementary schools, and they take our mobile kit Fox and our planetarium out to the elementary schools to have engagements with the children in the classroom environment. What we found is that the most expensive part of doing these outreach activities for the schools is buses and lunches, and so we've taken a little bit of that out of the equation where we take a planetarium to a school and we can contact 400 to 500 students in a day.
This is so much more than just an air show. It really is.
What we've really modeled it for is to create an interest in aviation at a young age, that engagement, to educate them at every chance that we can, and then to accelerate them into an actual profession that pays money. And everything that we do here sort of follows that trend from the 727 classroom. That 727 still works. We fire up. We do. We fire up the engines. The other day we had an event on the campus, and we invited, they're called the Old Farts. They're a flying group in Florida. I can't help the name. But we invited them here onto the campus. They ate lunch, and then they were wandering around. Well, an A&P class happened upon them, and within the Old Farts, there were several retired maintenance folks who'd worked on that 727, and they gave an impromptu class on how pressurization works on that aircraft. So it's just great that we can reach so many people of so many different generations that are interested in aviation.
Now, as I was walking over here to the museum area, I had to jump off the sidewalk because there were streams of people coming in, and a lot of young folks coming in too. How broad an area do you actually reach for the young people?
Well, so the great part is you were walking up here as the Blue Angel Seminar was ending, which that was incredibly inspirational. And so we actually had seven ROTC groups from around the area, the CAP, and a variety of other groups that had come in for that, and one elementary school, which a little bit surprised me because most of the field trip folks were a little bit older. But we will deliver our programs all the way from Homestead. We've been up in Pensacola, and part of what we do is there's no fee in Polk County. Polk County, as it turns out, it has only 80% the median income of the rest of the state of Florida. It's a relatively poor area, although there's all kinds of growth and development are happening in this area. So we deliver the program for free anywhere in Polk County and only for a transportation charge to go anywhere else in the state of Florida.
You know, it's amazing when you see young people, their eyes light up when they make connections with aviation. And I think it's an opportunity to impact them potentially for the rest of their lives.
And we have a number of folks who've grown up in our program. We have airline pilots that are 24, 25 years old that all they've ever known is the aviation world that we've created here at Sun and Fun and the Aerospace Center for Excellence. And you see it, that's my favorite part of this job is going out and doing programs, especially the outreach programs with the Kit Fox, because I'm a CFI, so I can explain some of the things that are happening with the Kit Fox when a kid just jumps in there and yanks around on the yoke. But you see that engagement have a positive impact. Then they come to our summer camps. We have great summer camps here. We have STEMtastic, and then we have Destination Aviation, where on the last day of the class, these kids get to go over to flight safety, and they get to fly with an actual flight safety instructor in an aircraft. We just have so many great programs, and you just see the initial engagement when they're young. We take them through the summer camps. They enroll over here at the Central Florida Aerospace Academy. They sometimes go to either Travis or Polk State. A lot of them go to Emory-Riddle. We see them through the course of time develop that interest and really enjoy aviation, and then it becomes a career, maybe a 40, 50-year career.
Now, you've gotten some recognition for achieving this amazing thing.
Yeah, in fact, ICAST recognized us for a program called Missionizing Your Air Show. And we've been going around giving presentations to other air shows around the country where they take the air show piece and then they turn it into a STEM festival. And then that STEM festival encourages additional investment in aviation. And the most recent one, the Portland Air Show, was out here, and they brought the superintendent, assistant superintendent of schools, and they brought the technical college folks, and they brought the air show folks, and we told them how we put things together. Now they're going to take that back, and they're going to look at how they can increase the opportunities from their air show for the aviation community in general in the Portland area. And it's really very enjoyable because we had a presentation out at the Lakeland Aero Club, and you could just see the teachers understand how STEM really makes sense when a kid picks up a wrench and they go, oh my gosh, I understand the difference between a quarter and an eighth and a half now, because it's not just fractions on a paper. It is, I have to figure out how this wrench works and how fractions work and so forth. And it's just wonderful because the teacher sees the student doing it and they're like, wow, this is just incredible.
Perfect. So Ed, how did you come to this dream job?
That's a really good question, because this is my first Sun and Fun. I was not involved in Sun and Fun at all. But our CEO here, John Lights Leendhouse, he was an F-18 driver, and he wanted someone who was willing to carry the banner for aviation and ACE and what we do here. I just didn't understand when I took the job that he was towing the banner behind an F-18. And it's felt like that hornet's been dragging me the whole way. But Sun and Fun actually reached out across the country, and they were looking for someone with specific skills. And I just feel very, very fortunate that I had those skills.
And you were in Wichita?
Actually, I was in Kansas City, but I was the director of aviation for the state of Kansas for about 8 years. And then I've been in airport consulting and also teaching for Kansas State University for the last 6 years. And I have a pretty significant aviation background. I was an aviation attorney and also a CFI, which being a lawyer and a CFI at the same time is always an interesting aspect of life. But this has been just an incredible opportunity.
What was the sort of initial spark? When did you first become aware of aviation as a youngster, maybe?
Yeah, it's the funny part was that I was like a lot of people, and I had bad eyesight, and a few little health issues, and I thought I could never fly. Well, I started running an airport as a city manager, and the flight instructor said, well, that's all hogwash. You can get a medical. It's no problem at all. And as soon as I started to learn to fly, that was all I ever wanted to do. I would rather fly than darn near anything. So being able to, give that opportunity to other people is really just a joy.
What about some of the other things going on here at Sun and Fun today? Interesting things. There's a drone zone.
There is a drone zone. The USF brain drone people are out in the drone zone today. They're flying the drone with just their brain. We're doing a couple of other things. We have a career fair that's going on from 9 to 2 today. The power went out in the tent yesterday, but we still had standing room only in there, which was crazy. The recruiters are saying this is the best. This has been a really good location for them to recruit from, that they're actually getting qualified folks coming through the area. We just uncrated the Able Flight aircraft. Zenith and Able Flight we're partnering with to offer scholarships to persons with disabilities who earn a scholarship through Able Flight. They'll come here onto our campus and we'll teach them to fly. Able Flight just offered their 100th scholarship. Zenith provided an airplane with hand controls that they've really run through the tests and everything else to make sure that they can accommodate folks, mostly quadriplegics, who are learning to fly. I just met a guy this morning who's actually out of Fort Lauderdale, who was one of their Able Flight graduates, and he said it completely changed his life. Navy veteran, had a car accident when he was they retired him from the Navy because he lost his arm, and he talked about how it was just such a life-changing experience because he was ready to give up. Yes. His life had changed so much, and then all of a sudden, he's part of the 1% that knows how to fly, you know, that has the absolute freedom of moving in four dimensions. And he said it just really changed his world and his perspective. And he would smile from ear to ear about being able to get involved in our Able Flight program. And we have an air show after a little while. Yes. You know, I just finished that Blue Angels forum. Those guys are they're just straightforward. But everybody else in the crowd was way amped up. It's going to be a great show. We've been hearing him practice, and so to see him actually go is going to be something else.
Yeah, it's great to be in the camping area when the first couple of F-18s went off this morning. It's a great way to start the day.
Well, and the funny part is, and if you want to experience aviation up close, the camping area is where it's at, because if you're parked in the north half of the camping area, you must vacate because you are in the show box. I mean, and I actually had a couple of people comment to me on the way in today about not understanding how close they were until you're standing in your RV and the vent shakes from the F-18 going over. We are way close. And so it's a cool experience. And just being at the Lakeland Linder Airport, the regular traffic they get here, wow. It's a great place to be if you like aviation.
Yeah, on camping and being that close, I'll be honest, I was not that thrilled with the idea of camping, because it's been many, many years since I've been in a tent on the ground. And I wasn't looking forward to it, but I have to tell you, though, the experience has really changed my mind on that. I mean, between the people that, you know, you're camping amongst, and the you know, the friendliness and the willingness to have conversations and being that close to the runway and all, is, I changed my mind. So I think next year when I come back, I think I'm going to camp again.
Well, and the fire pit is a great place for people to gather at night. We do have the theater that's showing movies. Last night it was Airplane. I didn't even have to be at the theater, and I was saying the lines along with, you know, "Don't call me Shirley." And then it really is that community that's out there. And you see all different kinds of camping that's going on. You know, virtually anything on wheels has a bed somewhere in it. Out there, and then you've got a lot of tent camping. And then over there in Camp Duffy, or just past Camp Duffy, there's actually the Brits that have come all the way over from England. You'd stop and talk to one of those kids. They just can't believe that they can do this kind of stuff, because you can't in England. And so they, you know, they're like, man, this, what great opportunities. They were over at the career fair, and I've seen them in a number of the university booths. They are just going crazy, because you just don't get this opportunity anywhere but here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as we start to wrap it up, how's the attendance been over the last years? Are we seeing a growth?
Well, this year we're actually setting records. So the first three days, we received our attendance reports from the CFO, and it looks like that we're ahead of any of our projections, ahead of anything that we thought would happen. And it had been trending that way up until the air show. We'd been seeing it look like we were actually going to do really well. We were trying to figure out if people had just finally figured out how to register online, and so we'd seen all the sales early. Yeah. But it turns out we're getting just as much gate admission. So it really is growing. One of the things that we're looking at for next year is we're really looking at trying to separate out our areas so that all of the show planes are up front, and people, if they bring in home-built planes, there's some place that they'll be viewed and seen by people walking through, and that we'll have our camping where camping should be and our planes where planes should be, and that it'll be a very good experience moving forward, a very concise experience, so that you can go and see and do what you want to do, and it's relatively easy to do.
And one thing I'll just comment quickly is the sound system for the air shows is spectacular. I don't think I've been at another air show where you could be almost anywhere, you know, along the, you know, the flight line there and hear as clearly as you can hear the announcers and all. It's really kind of remarkable.
Well, and the cool part about it is, and understand this, if you go to air shows, and we're all aviation geeks here, that our sponsors for this show are the ones that have provided the resources so that we can do things like that, that we can invest a little bit more in things like the sound system and some of the chalets and some of those things. So if you come to the air show, if you're out here at Sun and Fun, please pay attention to who the sponsors are and go and thank them, because frequently it's hard to measure the investment that they've made, whether or not they're getting a return. When you go and you say, hey, look, we really appreciate that. You may not buy the product there at their tent that day, but they understand that you're becoming a loyal customer because they are providing the things, including, this is a vacation for everybody, but the 26 and 3,500 volunteers, that you are enjoying yourself. You're developing that brand loyalty.
Very good, Ed. Thank you so much. I know you're very busy and need to get back to the, you know, all the things that happen behind the scenes. Maybe that'd be a conversation for the future that might be kind of interesting, is to hear some of those stories, the things that the attendees don't see.
Well, and I actually appreciate the refuge. I have not been in my office myself for a while, and getting to close the door and relax for a minute and just talk to you has been really great.
Good. So people, of course, can find more about Sun and Fun at flysnf.org. That's probably the hub for all the other places where people can learn information. All right, great. Thanks, Ed Young. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Max, the Central Florida Aerospace High School, the Restoration Center, the hangar, the museum. I mean, there's just all this activity going on all year long down there on this campus, where there also happens to be an air show for a week each year. You must have known that this was much greater than just the air show.
You know, it's interesting. My last time at Sun and Fun was probably on the order of 8 or 9 years ago, and they did not have the Central Florida Aerospace High School there at that time. So that's relatively new and had popped up in the time since I've been there. So I was surprised to see it. All the presentations I gave were in the high school, which made it really pretty convenient to be in a classroom, have projectors and all that kind of stuff. The last time I gave presentations at Sun and Fun, we were in tents, you know, scattered out in the field somewhere. So I was particularly impressed that, you know, such a thing actually exists. I have never heard of a high school before with an aerospace focus. I think this is probably unique, perhaps, you know, in the entire country. Maybe there's another one someplace I've never heard of. But it's fascinating to me that students can get ingrained in STEM kinds of subjects and aviation as well while they're in high school. So, yeah, I think it's a fantastic program.
Yeah, it's just amazing. They use this term missionizing, right? They missionized the air show, which is to start out with the foundation that you've got a great event, but you can use that to leverage a lot of other activities that help people pursue careers in aviation, you know, and do all of these other things. So the thing that we call Sun and Fun and think of as the air show, it really funds a lot of these other activities. So that was kind of an eye-opening experience. Well, I also spoke to a small aircraft interiors company. It's called Aviation X. And listen to my conversation there. I'm visiting Aviation X Aircraft Interiors. And who am I speaking with?
Cecilia Lopez.
Cecilia Lopez. And you previously were at a different location, and you've relocated.
Correct. We used to be in Camarillo, California, and now we're located in Houston, Texas, which is actually Conroe, Texas, which is about an hour drive from downtown Houston.
And tell us a little bit about the service that you provide. You do aircraft interiors, custom restoration, things like that?
Correct. So we work from home built all the way up to global citations, anything we do. So we do headliners, window trims, carpet, seats, glare shields, anything that you need, we get it done here. And it's all 100% customized. We can do from fabrics up to Italian leather.
So is some of it just basic restoration, and is other jobs that you have is more kind of custom interiors?
Yeah, so a majority of our job is custom. So a customer comes and says, this is what I want, brings in a couple pictures. We go ahead, draw them on the iPad and figure it out, pick out colors, and the customer approves the design. And then we go ahead and bring it up to life in the airplane.
So tell me a little bit about some of the custom interiors. Can you give us some examples of kind of interesting or different things or practical things that some people have come to you for?
Yes. So we've done diamond plating. We've done stripes. The aircraft we have on display right now has a wave on it. So any design, any double stitching, double tone seats, anything. We do seatbelt plating. We do cabinetry, special armrest. Anything that pretty much we can do, we get it done.
And this company's been operating for a while.
Yes. So my dad started back the company when he started. I think he was about 16, 17-year-old when he started the company.
Oh, wow.
And now I'm 22, so I wasn't born until he was 18, so the company's been around for a while.
Are you running the company now?
So now I'm running the company, yes.
You are, yes.
Yes.
Oh, good.
So my dad does the interiors. He works the production area, and I work all of the office, selling, expo, anything that gets the customer through the door.
So where did the expertise for doing this kind of work come from?
My dad learned it. He learned, his mom was, she would sew, so he learned to sew. So my uncle's, actually my dad's family is in the aircraft family world. So my uncle is the mechanic for the LAPD helicopters. So he's a mechanic out there, and he got my dad into, he used to do interiors too, so then he went to mechanic. My dad took over what he was doing, and that's how it, and it just stayed in the family pretty much.
And how many employees are there?
10. So far we have 10 employees. We don't like to grow out too much because it is custom, so we try to dedicate and focus on details of every client. Since we did move to Texas and we do have a bigger facility and a bigger space, we are recruiting new employees and we are looking for new employees at the moment. But we try to stay small to teach our employees the detail and attention and all that.
And how long does a custom job take? I'm sure it varies a lot. But nothing too crazy and extravagant. How long does that kind of work usually take?
So we pride ourselves on how fast we can get an airplane in and out. So, for example, a Cessna 182, we can get it in between 2 to 3 weeks. The leading time is really hard for us because it depends on the materials we're ordering from. So sometimes it takes about 3 to 5 days for materials to come in. While materials are coming in, we are stripping out the aircraft, checking that everything is in top shape, because we do have an AMP and IA on field that checks all of our interiors and makes sure that everything's good. And he checks everything while the interior is coming out. And then what, once the material comes in, is just to cover everything and put everything back in. So about 2 to 3 weeks.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Do you fly yourself?
I am earning my pilot's license at the moment. Yes. Yes. So I'm scared of heights. So it's taken me a while to be up there, but I'm getting up there. Hopefully I'll be done by this year.
And what are you learning in this airplane here?
No, I'm learning at a school.
Yes.
Based in Conroe, Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just learning on a small Piper at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. What is exciting to you about flying?
There is no limits on flying. You can go anywhere and see anything.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the most exciting part.
That sounds great. Well, good luck with your getting your license and everything. And tell our listeners where they can learn more about this company, a website probably, or other social media places.
Yes. So we are at aviationxai.com, and we are also on Camarillo Aircraft Interiors. We're also on Instagram and Facebook.
All right. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
While I was with the Aviation X Aircraft Interiors, I had an opportunity to look at their, you know, their workmanship and some of the interiors that they had done, and they were very impressive. I mean, this is quality stuff, and it was just sort of fascinating to talk to, you know, a family-owned business. They've been doing this for a while, very, you know, very skilled at it. And when I was looking at their website after Sun and Fun, I learned that they were one of the 2019 Sun and Fun Award winners. One of their clients, Cessna 182s, a 1967 182, won Outstanding in Type with their custom interior design. So congratulations for that.
And it's pretty neat how if you were to look at a new Cessna 182, it's probably, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'm sure it's in excess of $400,000. And yet you can buy something from the 1960s or 70s for less than $100,000. And,
yeah,
you know, essentially make it in many ways equivalent to a new aircraft, not just with the interior, but of course with adding modern avionics as well, too.
Along the way, I had a conversation with Trevor Simino, a young high school student. Ran into him on the back deck of Sun and Fun Radio, and just listen to what this youngster has accomplished. One of the new people I've met here at Sun and Fun is Trevor Simino. Trevor, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks, Max. It's great to be here.
Now, you've had sort of some interesting projects going on, but first let's talk about your interest in aviation.
Yeah, absolutely. So neither of my parents are pilots, but I found aviation through actually the space shuttle program. When I was little, I used to want to be a space shuttle astronaut, and then that program was canceled. And, you know, growing up in Florida, I was really fortunate to have the space shuttle in my backyard. And that was really what inspired my interest in aerospace and aviation. And then once the program was canceled, I did some research and I found that a lot of the space shuttle astronauts started in general aviation. That's kind of how I found general aviation. Then on my 10th birthday, my parents surprised me with a Young Eagles flight and a Piper Cub. And that is just what ignited the my passion for aviation. And it's been nonstop ever since.
So have you been to any rocket launches?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Most of the space shuttle launches after 2003, which is the year I was born, we went to. It's like I said, I'm so fortunate to have grown up in Florida, Central Florida, with Kennedy Space Center right in my backyard. It's fantastic.
I know. I was always sad that I never, over the years, made it down to see any launches. I especially missed out on some Apollo mission launches, and that would have been just spectacular. And then after that, I thought, well, okay, now we have ultimately the space shuttle, so I'll get down to see one of those. And I never got to see one of those either. I think a Falcon 9 was supposed to launch this morning, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it went up this morning or tomorrow. I think it got moved back a few days. But yeah, you've got SpaceX down there now, so there's definitely a lot of action happening down at Kennedy Space Center right now with SpaceX and Boeing and Blue Origin. They're all kind of making their strides, so yeah.
It can be kind of hit and miss, right? If you come down, if you don't live close by, if you come down for a launch, you may get rescheduled, you may see one, you may not. So you kind of roll the dice a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of just like flying, you're at the mercy of the weather sometimes, and not always, sometimes the weather isn't always good, and, you have to learn how to deal with it.
Yeah. I think I need to make a trip to see a launch, because I don't think I want to wait too much longer. Just the noise, the feeling in your gut, right? You can actually feel these launches as well as hear them.
Oh, you can, for sure. I definitely recommend that you attend one sometime soon. So that's where my passion started. And like I said, I found out that most of the astronauts were in the general aviation industry before, and that's where I found general aviation.
So you've been flying yourself?
I have, yeah. So, I took my first flight when I was 10, and I've been flying ever since, and I've been in flight training now. And I turned 16 on June 21st, 2019, which is just a couple months away, and I'm hopefully planning on soloing on my 16th birthday. Knock on wood, the weather's good. That's the plan.
And I have to believe your parents are very supportive of this.
They are. They are absolutely incredible. I wouldn't be able to do anything near what I'm able to do if it weren't for the support of them.
And what are you flying? What are you learning to fly in? What are you taking your lessons in?
So I'm learning flying a Cessna 172P model, a great airplane. It actually was just upgraded with 2G5s and got a new paint job. So very nice airplane. And yeah. I love it. It's awesome.
That's cool. Now, you have another interesting project, right? You started a little business, I guess.
That's right. That's how I actually pay for my flight training. So when I was 11, I knew that I needed a way to fund flight training, because I knew that this is something that I wanted to do. So I created a company called Chart It All. And what we do at Chart It All is we are the original creators of all of your favorite custom aeronautical chart products. So shirts, socks, leggings, phone cases, coffee mugs, coasters, the list goes on. We do a lot of really cool stuff, and it's all custom. So it's your home airport, your airspace, whatever area you want. It is literally 100% customizable. You give us an airport code, you give us some latitude and longitudes, and we make it happen.
And so describe some of the products. Like, I know I saw some of the shirts yesterday. I think you were wearing one, and I saw a couple other shirts. Sort of describe what they are.
That's right. We have the shirts, we have leggings. We use a special process called dye sublimation, and that means that the ink is actually embedded into the fabric. And because of that, the quality is really high for all of them. They're not going to wash out or fade out. So the chart is crystal clear on all of the products.
I guess it's silk screening is like the other process that you could use, but yeah, the dye sublimation is a higher quality way to do that. And so what you end up with, at least in the case of what I saw yesterday, is a shirt that's completely covered, by the chart. And I'm sure that would get a lot of attention from other people.
Right. It is seam to seam. It is literally all over printed, and it does get a lot of attention. I'll constantly work fly-ins and air shows, and I always get stopped and tell people about it, and it's really fun. The other thing that I like about it is, like you said, it does draw attention, and it's a conversation piece. Because, and one of the reasons why I like that it's custom is you are able to, you know, someone can buy a shirt with their home airport or maybe the airport that they first soloed at, and then tell that story when someone asks them about it. You know, in aviation, you know, I don't know who said this originally, but you don't come, you know, you come to an air show the first year for the planes, then you come back for the people. You know, aviation is all about that that family community, and the people are just so cool. The planes are so cool. And being able to have that kind of conversation with your aeronautical chart shirt, you know, the story about your engine out landing, whatever it may be, it's just, it sparks really cool conversation, and that's what it's all about, you know?
Yeah, the community aspect is really strong here at Sun and Fun. You can really feel it, and it doesn't take very long for you to start to feel it, just from the people you interact with and the people that you meet. So I imagine that if you're you know, wearing a shirt or have other some of the other product leggings or other products, that any other pilot is going to know immediately what that is, and then that can start a conversation, you know, based on that. But they're so interesting because there's so much on them, you know, on an aeronautical chart, that someone who is not you know, part of aviation or not a pilot, I imagine is just, you know, not going to have any idea what that is, and they may say, you know, geez, what, that's really different. You know, where does that come from? And that lets you start a conversation then with somebody who, you know, maybe wouldn't otherwise be talking about aviation.
Absolutely. You know, it's gotten a very good positive response from people who aren't in aviation, because you know, we'll wear it around every once in a while, and you know, people will come up to us and say, hey, what is that? That's really cool. And we'll explain it, and it's cool because, you know, The whole idea, you know, I started the company to pay for my flight training, but I also started it because I want to be able to, you know, show students and kids in aviation that it is possible to become a pilot, and it is not this, you know, extremely difficult, impossible challenge that, you know, that is out there, and it is possible. And, you know, by sharing this kind of stuff with the general public who may not be familiar with aviation, it kind of is a way to get them slowly more familiar with general aviation, because unfortunately I think that the perception of GA is really poor with the general public. A lot of people don't really it's not their fault, they just aren't familiar with it. So by being able to start those conversations and start, you know, explaining, like, oh well, yeah, this is the airport that my friends and I went to go pick up our friend, and then we went to have lunch here, you know, that kind of stuff, because that's what GA is all about. And it's sharing it with others too. I think that's so important, and you know, you never know who you're going to meet. We've gotten a lot of really positive response from the general public too, not just folks in aviation.
So how difficult was it for a young person to start up a company? Were there some big challenges, or how did you figure out how to do this?
Yeah, you know, there are challenges. It is a full-time job. When I started the company in 2015, you know, my parents have been there from the beginning. They've been incredibly supportive. And like I said before, I could not do it without them. And for the first year or so, it was kind of like a hobby. You know, we debuted at Sun and Fun 2015, and after that, it slowed down a little bit. We sold it to some of our friends, sold it to, you know, pilots that we knew, and we had a little Google site. But then, you know, about 2 years ago, we sat down and we said, okay, this has some serious potential. Are we going to just let it kind of die out, or are we going to take it and run with it? We decided to take it and run with it, and now we are in Sporty's Pilot Shop. We work with AOPA, EAA. We're at Oshkosh every single year. We're going to be working with Women in Aviation this year. I mean, we've got some really exciting stuff on the horizons.
Wow. Yeah, that is very exciting. Do you have any other projects coming up, or this is probably absorbing most of your time and energy?
It is certainly time-consuming, but I do like to stay busy. I'm the president of an organization called Aviation Explorer 747, which I don't know if you're familiar with police and fire exploring, but it is an exploring program within the Boy Scouts, but it's the aviation side of things, and we're actually partners with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and Piedmont Airlines, and we do some really incredible stuff. We're a pretty big group, and we go on field trips, we have guest speakers, we do ground schools, so that is a very time-consuming thing. I'm also slowly but surely in the process of starting an aviation YouTube channel, because I've been really inspired by, you know, Matt Guthmiller and you know, Josh Flowers from Aviation 101, and I've been fortunate to get to know them very well, and they've really inspired me to kind of do it, and I think it'd be another just incredible way to share the story of Chart It All and inspire other students to get involved in aviation.
Have you done any videos before?
I have, yeah. So I do have experience with it, and I'm actually at a point now where I've recorded you know, a dozen videos. It's going through the editing process and taking time. So I'm trying to get them all edited, and then I'm going to release them on a schedule, and then, you know, so on and so forth. But yeah, so if you just search my name on YouTube, Trevor Simoneau, it's just Simoneau. Find the channel, subscribe, it'd be awesome, appreciate it. And yeah, we'll see where it goes. It's just another fun side project for me right now, but we'll see what happens.
This is amazing. Do you have time to go to school in between all these other things?
I do, yes. I'm a junior in high school right now. I'm in the IB program at Deland High School in Volusia County, Florida, and I love it. It's a whole lot of fun. It is a lot of work, and it is time-consuming on top of everything else, but I love it. It's fun.
Wow. Busy guy, Trevor. Tell our listeners once more where they can find the website online or any other, you know, online presence you have, social media.
Absolutely. You can go to chartitall.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at chartitall. We post some really fun stuff. We love when customers send us their pictures, and then we also like to share inspiring stories in aviation. So, yeah, be sure to go check us out, follow us there. And once again, that's just chartitall.com. We have some pretty cool stuff. Go check it out.
Trevor, thanks so much. You're an amazing young man. You got a lot of things going on. It's just wonderful. I really like the way that you sought out a way to fund your the training experience. So many people have difficulties coming up with funds for that, and you've showed, I think, one very viable way that you can accomplish that. So thanks for talking with our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you.
Quite a remarkable young man, I think.
He is. I met Trevor last summer at Air Venture in Oshkosh, and he was one of the more memorable people I ran into there at the time. He was at an evening gathering where a number of podcasters were gathered for the evening. I think, in fact, that was something that Launchpad Marzari had put together for us. But the thing that, you know, might not have come out in this interview with him, which really struck me at the time, is this young man is hilarious. he just had us all in stitches. He was really, really funny. And, you know, he was just very easygoing, laid back, and, you know, was very comfortable with adults. And he was just funny. You know, he was, he was standing there in essentially what looked like knee high, socks that were sectionals. And, he was just a fun young man having a great time. You know, and it was really fun meeting him. So it was nice to bump into him again at Sun and Fun. And, you know, my guess is this is probably not the first company, or rather not the last company that he's going to start.
No doubt.
He really, really has an entrepreneurial bent. And I think we'll be hearing lots about this young man in the future.
I think you're right. And I did find that his YouTube channel is up. I subscribed today, actually. So I will have a link to that in the show notes. Well, next up, I talked with Tom Perkowski. He's the co-founder and president of Eagle Cap Software. So they have an interesting product, but they also have an interesting resource, something that's really simple, but is very handy for introducing aviation to youngsters. So here's myself and Tom. I'm with Tom Perkowski from Eagle Cap Software. He's the co-founder, actually. Tom, welcome to Sun and Fun.
Thanks for having me, Max. It's great to be here for another year.
Now, this is my first year here, believe it or not. I can hardly believe it. This is certainly not going to be my last year here. Have you been coming for a while?
Yes. I'm not sure how many years it's been. I don't have a count, but it's been quite a few. I enjoy it.
Now, Eagle Cap Software is a company that produces software that's all aviation-related, right?
That's correct. We specialize in building flight operations software. Our specialty is in the area of dispatch and operation systems, and also front-of-the-aircraft systems, so mapping systems, other EFB-related software.
And how did you get into that business? What caused you to co-found this company?
Well, our company is made up of a bunch of former aviation folks who have decades of experience in the aviation industry. Some of them had kind of gotten to the end of their formal careers and wanted to do something different. Others of us kind of jumped on the train because we were, you know, we wanted to do something different as well. I'm one of the kind of the ones that jumped off one train and onto another. But we've got a great company of people now building really good software for commercial aviation airlines, for example, as well as some business aviation app providers.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of folks, when they retire after a career in aviation, they can't seem to get very far away from it for one reason. And sometimes that just means a lot of flying. Sometimes that means forming a company. You have a new product, an app.
That's correct. We developed an application over the course of the last couple of years, and it's actually an infrastructure for building vector-based aeronautical charts, and then a system to download that data onto an iPad in order to have it locally while the iPad's offline. What we've done is taken that infrastructure and now have created an app. It's called Aviation Charting Service. That's the name of the service, but it's the app is Aero Charting. And we've put it up in the App Store, and it's a free app to use because we've taken that investment and actually put it into this app.
And who's the target audience for this app?
The target audience is a general aviation pilot who wants a really simple app to use. If you want something more complex, there's a lot of great apps out there for that type of pilot. But if you are looking for an app that you just want to open up and go, it's just simple and easy to use. That's what the Aero Charting app is for.
And that's how you're differentiating yourself from other products that are out there.
That's correct. Like I said, there's a lot of other great products out there, but we're just building a nice, simple to use, easy to use app for pilots. And hey, it may even be just something you want to open it up when you're on your flight to figure out where you are along the path. So it's just it's a nice, lightweight application to have on your iPad.
Were there any development challenges to create that app?
We mostly passed those development bridges in the past in terms of developing our infrastructure service and other products, and we were able to actually turn this app around in about 3 months or so, which is relatively quick from an app development perspective. And now we're adding in additional features as we get them. We have a small and growing user community, and they're providing feedback. So one of the first things we've added into the app is range rings. Folks are asking for range rings. And then the current version also has the ability to add in VFR and IFR, what we would call in the industry raster-based charts. So the charts that you typically would see on paper are now in the app.
Yeah. Do you have the developer resources in-house?
Yes, all the development resources are in-house. They're all EagleCap employees that are helping us build this application.
Yeah, that's good because sometimes if you employ contractors basically to do the software, the development, the writing, the coding itself, they're a little more removed from the company, the purpose, what you're trying to do with the app. So when you have that kind of a resource in-house, I imagine that makes it, that probably impacts the quality and the speed.
Well, actually, with our contractors, we've known some of our contractors for 20-some-odd years now. We actually have a strong cadre of folks that when we have to surge in order to do a customer project to go out to. So we're actually pretty lucky that way. I know a lot of folks in the tech industry are having trouble recruiting folks, but we actually have folks who actually are saying, hey, when's the next project you guys got coming in? We want to come back and work on it. We like the type of work you guys are doing.
Yeah, that's a good place to be.
Yeah, it's a very nice place to be. It's a unique place to be. We're very lucky for that.
Yes. So other features that you might talk about or usability kinds of considerations?
Sure. One of the things we have in the app is the ability to put in your route, and we are integrated with the AOPA Internet Flight Planner. So if you're an AOPA member and you use Internet Flight Planner, you can ingest all those AOPA routes into Aero Charting, and they'll show up.
Good. Where can folks learn more?
Folks can go to our website, aerocharting.com. Or just go out to the App Store and download it. It's a free app, so there's no harm in downloading it to the iPad and checking it out.
Yep. Great. One thing I wanted to mention though is we were talking beforehand about the way that you try to help young people who might become interested in aviation to sort of explore those possibilities. Maybe you could mention what you've developed here.
Sure. And this kind of stems from an instance I had when I was a young person. I had trouble finding information on aviation and actually was given some bad vectors early on in my life. And I said, okay, I'm gonna figure out a way to get that information out there. And I started with a top 3 list, and it's grown to a top 5. And now we have our top 10 list of learn to fly resources, and we have it on a little card that I give out. It's actually our literature, but on the front is learn to fly resources, and it's actually on our website as well. So if you go to eaglecapsoftware.com/learn to fly, you can download it. It's a PDF, so you can put it up at your kid's school, your the office where you work. But it's just a great way to get information out there to folks who might be interested in flying but don't really know where to start in terms of that search.
And you were telling me a story about a youngster who asked if you were a pilot.
Yep, I was on a business trip and traveling on MARTA from the Atlanta airport up in the town, and a young man was sitting across me, saw my suitcase, said, "Sir, are you a pilot?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "That's something I really want to do when I grow up." He's a high school kid. I'm like, "Well, here's a resource for you." I pulled our Learn to Fly resources out of my bag and gave it to him. I had never heard anything from him or had any follow-up, but I just hope that, you know, those instances have happened to me multiple times, and that it's just our little way as a company of making an impact on whether it's a future pilot, a future mechanic, or even a future software developer who's interested in aviation. That's our way of helping the community.
Yeah, that's great, because you know, it's serendipity. I mean, these kind of situations, you don't know when they might arise or when you might have an opportunity to influence somebody. And if you have a little takeaway, something that, you know, that the youngster could take with him, I think that's pretty powerful. And, yeah, you'll probably never know what happened. Maybe nothing, maybe something spectacular, you know, with that kid when they grow up. But, hey, you know, you've done something. That's great. Yeah. So that's cool. That's cool. All right, so again, the website where we can learn more?
The website is aerocharting.com, or again, go out to the Apple App Store and download it for your iPad.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Max.
And we'll have that link in the show notes to the top 10 list of aviation resources. I think it's a brilliant idea. I mean, how often do you just randomly run across someone, a young person or anybody, who has, well, some interest in aviation and hasn't really started down that path. And this top 10 list of resources that Tom and Eagle Cap Software have is just a handy thing to have in your pocket and just, you know, pass it out, hand it out when the situation presents itself.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are interested in learning to fly find it a little daunting to just kind of sort out, well, how do you go about it? Because, you know, there are many, many paths that can lead to a private pilot certificate, and it's just not obvious to an outsider trying to figure out, okay, how do I penetrate this strange, culture of you know, different words and languages and different kinds of flight schools. And, yeah, it can be confusing.
Yes. All right, and finally, we have Laura Radigan. She's a glider pilot that has been competing and will be competing in some impressive championships. So here's Laura.
The gliders here I'm really happy because over the years, gliders and soaring and glider aerobatics has been very poorly represented at air shows.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, you have a few artists. You have Manfred Radius, who is a very famous air show performer that is going to be performing here at Sun and Fun Friday and Saturday. But other than that, there aren't too many performances. This year, we have two of the STEM-A touring motor gliders here. We have an ASH-26E pure glider here. I have my SCD-59 aerobatic glider over at the Aerobatics Club booth. Rand Vollmer from Pipistrel has a Pipistrel Cinus touring motor glider over here.
I went up in that yesterday.
Isn't that a fantastic ship? I've flown this ship a number of times. And then there's also a Lambda over here somewhere. I saw it last night at one of the dinners.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. The only way you can really tell it's not a light sport is it has the air brakes popping out of the wings. So seeing so much representation with gliders at this event really makes me feel good. I'm really proud to see soaring represented so well at this event. I think this is the best showing we've ever had.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So you have a fairly long career in terms of aerobatics.
Well, no, actually I don't. everybody seems to think because of where I'm at in the sport that I've been doing this for a long time, and that's not really the case.
No?
My first ride in a general aviation aircraft was 6 years ago.
No kidding.
Yes. I went out to Seminole Lake Lighterport, did a discovery flight, found out I liked it, had an aptitude for it, started taking lessons. Once I got my glider ticket, I got my single engine, and then I've gone through instrument training and tailwheel and high performance and complex and high altitude and Cirrus checkout and seaplane rating and so on and so forth. So basically, I've been in some type of flight training or preparing for some type of a check ride for the last 6 years. It's okay. Just been a nonstop process. And that's how I've gotten to where I am. But fortunately, you know, I learned very early on that I really enjoy aerobatics, and I've had a steady procession of amazing instructors.
So what is it about aerobatics that draws you in?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of people that enjoy roller coasters, and I always kid people, you know, glider aerobatics has absolutely ruined me for the theme parks, because there's absolutely nothing in the theme parks that can compare to driving the bus, so to speak. I get to dive into the box. I'm looking at the ground coming up at 160 miles an hour, and I yank 6.5 G's. You just can't get that in any theme park. So it's thrilling. It's exhilarating. It's physically demanding. But it's my thing. I was very fortunate when I got into aviation very early on. I found my thing. A lot of people search for it. They never find it. But I got it, and I just grabbed hold with both hands, and I'm not letting go.
Did you have difficulty finding the right kind of flight instructor? I know some pilots, you know, need to search a little bit to find the right match.
That's very true. I was very fortunate because the gentleman that's coming down here to fly in the air show, Manfred Radius, he's a Canadian, and he comes down to Florida, and Sun and Fun is his first air show of the season. And he comes down to Seminole Lake Lighterport to practice before the air show season because we've got a jet flying through here. So I was able to... I'm sorry. I was able to reach out to him, and he actually started my aerobatic training. And having a world-renowned, you know, Barber Award air show performer as your first aerobatics instructor
is pretty much
hitting it out of the ballpark.
Absolutely.
So I've had a number of instructors. I currently fly out to Arizona 2 or 3 times a year and fly with a gentleman by the name of Jason Stevens, who is a previous U.S. national aerobatic champion, and he was also the pilot that flew the glider scene in the movie 50 Shades of Grey. If you ever saw that movie where they roll the glider, well, he was the pilot that did that. So Jason and I are going to be competing both in the World Championship this year and the U.S. Nationals. We're going to be going in July to Deva, Romania for 3 weeks to fly in the World Championships. And then in September, we're going to be flying in Kansas at the U.S. Nationals. And then I've been invited to go to Southern Arizona for the Southwest Regional Championship in November. So my schedule is getting pretty full, and I'm really having a good time.
So tell us a little bit about the competition and the different categories, different classes, for those listening who aren't familiar with aerobatic competition with gliders. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, the International Aerobatics Club, or the IAC, is the governing body that basically controls the formatting here in the United States of how aerobatics, both powered and glider, is managed. Everybody pretty much starts out in what they call the sportsman category. The sportsman category has easy figures to fly. It has fewer figures in the program, so it's less demanding on the pilot and the aircraft.
Figures meaning the pattern you fly?
The exact whether a loop is a figure, a stall turn is a figure, a dive, you know, any type, you're given figures to fly. It's like a let's kind of look at it as when you're flying a known program at a competition, think of that as like the compulsories in figure skating. Everyone is given those figures ahead of time. They're allowed to practice them as much as they want. And the judges pretty much expect perfection because you've had lots of time to rehearse this.
So how is the scoring done?
The scoring is done by a panel of judges on the ground. And they watch and they judge you based upon the precision which you execute the figures. They have a program card down on the ground and they know what you're going to fly in and what sequence. So you not only do you have to fly the figures correctly, you have to fly them in the correct sequence and in the correct direction.
Are there also degrees of difficulty?
Absolutely. So the sportsman category is relatively easy and the judging criteria is fairly low because they want to get people engaged in the sport and keep them engaged in the sport. Then you have the intermediate category, you have the advanced category, and you have the unlimited category. And each category, as you ascend in skill level, the figures become more complex, more difficult, and in some cases, you need specialized aircraft to be able to fly them. So as you move, some people stay in the lower categories for their entire flying career because they have one aircraft and they use it for transportation and occasional competition. I have two dedicated aircraft that I use for aerobatics, and that's what they're used for. And they're designed to pull the high Gs and pull the hard maneuvers that are required in the higher categories.
How do you finance this? Do you have sponsors?
I have a couple of sponsors. I have Method 7 Eyewear. I'm wearing their new design,
very nice.
Prescription Progressive sunglasses. We have a booth here at Sun and Fun. I know the Prescription Progressives are not the characteristic Method 7 blue glasses like everybody's used to seeing. We're working on that. We're coming out with a new coating to make them blue, but I've got the first prototypes of these, so they're black. Dare to Fly Fashion. I'd like to say hi to Jen Toplick and all the people at Dare to Fly. They've helped me out tremendously. You know, and a lot of it is self-financed. Seminole Lake Lighterport has been a huge help. You know, Arizona Soaring, the coaching and the mentoring I've received from Jason Stevens and his staff out at Arizona Soaring has been a huge asset. You know, I get a little help, but by and large, a lot of this is self-financed.
And how about the path through competition leading up to your participation in what's coming up this year?
Well, obviously, you start in regional competitions, local regional competitions. The problem with gliders that the powered people don't really have, when you go to a regional competition, you call up the contest director and you say, hey, I want to bring my glider. They go, wonderful, we'd love to have you. Bring your plane, bring a tow plane, bring a tow pilot. So there's additional expenses involved in this. So a lot of the regional competitions I don't attend, not because I don't have the time, not because I want to skip the regional competitions. I would love to fly more competitions. The problem is I cannot afford all those additional expenses. Now, at the national and the international competitions, they contract a tow pilot and an aircraft that tows all of the gliders, and you just pay a percentage of the overall cost of that pilot and plane being at the competition. So it's more evenly distributed amongst the larger body of competitors. Glider aerobatics here in the United States, outside of the national level, is not very common. And I don't understand why. I'm trying to change that by exhibiting here and bringing glider aerobatics more to the forefront, but it's an uphill struggle. We're still working to get there.
How about for someone, maybe a youngster who hasn't started down the path of getting a pilot's license, who might think about gliders someday? What's the path? Do you recommend getting a powered license first, or what would you advise a young person to do?
Actually, a student pilot can solo a glider at 14. And I highly recommend young people, if they're considering a path in aviation, to start in soaring. They can start younger. They can gain valuable stick and rudder skills and learn the process flow that goes, you know, the pre-flighting and the general aeronautical knowledge that you have to be a powered pilot. I took the path. I'm sorry. I started in gliders and then moved into power. So I'm a big advocate, you know, it made my powered flying very easy. Because, I mean, if you could land an airplane without a motor and you can put it on the numbers without a motor, when you have a motor, it just makes it that much easier. Yeah. So, yeah, I recommend everyone start in gliders first and then make the move to powered if that's the direction they want to go. They won't regret it.
Great, great. How can we follow you online or you know, track your progress? Tell us about social media or anything like that.
Wonderful. Yes, I do have a Facebook page, obviously. It's Laura Radigan at Facebook. And I have a YouTube channel with a lot of my aviation videos on there, and I'm always putting new content up. It is YouTube/ Laura Radigan, LauraRadigan. I'm working with my daughter. Unfortunately, I'm not as social media savvy as some of the younger people. So my daughter—that's
probably healthy.
Yeah,
these days.
My daughter is actually teaching me how to use Instagram and Snapchat and all these other social media platforms and hashtag this and hashtag that. I'm getting there. I'm not quite there yet. Give me a little time, and I'll make it happen.
Yeah, that's great. But you have a YouTube channel, so you put GoPros or something on the plane.
When I fly, a lot of my flying, my practicing is done without any coaching on the ground because finding good coaches is hard. So what I do, since Jason is a world-class competitor and he knows what to look for, I'll take the content from the SD cards of all the GoPro cameras. I'll put it on a what do they call that thing? A board, whatever, a server, and he'll download it and he'll evaluate my practice, and then he'll critique it and call me up and say, you need to do this, you need to do that. I want you to refly this figure, and when you do it, I want you to do this input instead of that input. So it's kind of long-distance coaches. I fly it in Florida. He judges it in Arizona. He sends it back to me, and I refly it. So I typically fly with anywhere between 3 and 5 GoPros on the glider, so we have all the necessary angles so that he can see the instrument panel for the entry speeds for all of the figures, one on the wing to see the angles to make sure the verticals up and down are vertical, one looking at me over the tail so that he can see the rudder deflection for the figures, and I basically put that on the board thing or something, and he and the server, and he downloads it and evaluates it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I like that idea. That's got to be worth a lot.
It's huge having that asset available to me.
Okay, great. Laura Radigan, fantastic. Is there one question that you get most often from people who want to know something about gliders?
Well, there's a lot of common misconceptions about gliders and soaring in general, not so much aerobatics. People are always, well, gliders, you tow them to altitude and you turn loose from the tow plane and 10 minutes later you're on the ground. Nothing could be further from the truth. You've seen some of the gliders we have here.
Yes.
They will go off and they will go soaring for hundreds and hundreds of miles and fly for hours.
Yes.
On thermals. And the way that works basically is the sun comes out, it heats the earth. The earth then heats the surrounding air, and that air, when it's warmer, becomes less dense and begins to rise. What we do is we seek out those rising columns of air called thermals, and we circle in them. And if we are going up in a thermal faster than the glider is coming down, we're climbing. We can climb like any other airplane. So we go from area of lift to area of lift, cross country, and fly. I've flown all the way to the Georgia-Florida border from Central Florida and back in one day in my glider.
Yeah.
And that's by no means a record.
How do you find thermals? I mean, I imagine there are some places where it's known to be an area with a lot of thermals, but if you're doing a kind of a cross-country, what do you look for in order to find thermals?
Well, the easiest thing is you look for the large, puffy cumulus clouds with the big flat bottom, because what happens is, I mentioned earlier about the rising air. As the air rises, it cools. When it cools to the point where it is now the same temperature as the air surrounding it, the moisture content in that air condenses and creates a visible cloud that you can see if there's enough moisture in the air. Today, you don't have enough moisture. You'll see a puffy cumulus cloud form right where the thermal is. So that's why you typically see gliders circling under a flat bottom cumulus cloud, because that's the source of the lift. And the source of the lift stops at cloud base. So they fly under the clouds, not on top of the clouds.
Okay, fascinating, fascinating. All right, well, Laura, good luck in the competition. We'll follow along. We'll put links to Laura's YouTube page and everything in the show notes, so you'll be able to find them there. And again, Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, Laura had her own glider there on display, and it was kind of fun after we had that conversation to just hang out a little bit around her and her glider. And kids would come up and ask lots of questions about it, and Laura, of course, was very accommodating and very helpful in helping, you know, spread the word about gliders. I certainly learned a lot from that conversation, and we'll have links in the show notes to her YouTube channel. I thought it was particularly interesting, Max West, how, because her mentor is somewhere else and certainly not up in the glider with her, how she employed this technique of setting a lot of GoPro cameras in and around the, you know, the aircraft, filming that, and then providing that to her mentor, her instructor later for critique. It was kind of an interesting way to, well, to improve your skills.
Yeah, that is really clever. I have never heard of anybody doing anything quite like that. I mean, I think people classically think of mentors as people who are meeting face-to-face, but it really proves that, no, we really don't have that kind of limitation on mentorship relationships.
That's right. All right. Well, we have one more that we're going to play in the next episode of the UAV Digest. This was a conversation with Embry-Riddle, the UAS Flight Standards and Training Manager, about some of the activities at Embry-Riddle. They have a Bachelor of Science in Unmanned Systems Science, and that's a four-year program. And then after that, students move on up to the Penguin C, which is a drone that comes from UAV Factory. And they had a couple of those there. And it's just a really interesting aircraft. When you look at a professional level, I mean, something that's $100,000 and above, it's not constructed at all like your DJI Phantom. A lot of machined aircraft grade aluminum and parts like that. So you can look for that at theuavdigest.com. All right, what's up with the geeks? Either of you guys got anything?
Yeah, I received a copy of Flying Magazine in the mail today, and I was thrilled to see it. It was an interview that someone had done months ago, and he's well known to everybody here. That was Rob Mark, and this is in the May issue of Flying Magazine. And it's all about learning to fly. It looks like it's the biggest, longest article in here. It's got several parts. But back in the second half of it, which is the practical guide to learning to fly, they mention interviews with a number of flight instructors, most of whom are good friends of mine, which is kind of interesting. And there's pictures of a couple of us on the center page there. So I've got Doug Stewart on one side. Doug was the 2004 National Flight Instructor of the Year, good friend of mine from the New York Hudson River area there. And a picture here of a student pilot who I don't know, who is in the Chicago area. So that's obviously somebody Rob knows. But they also interviewed Meg Guadalewski up in the Northwest, who I've known for probably at least 10 years. And let's see, Jason Miller, who a lot of people know from the Finer Points. He's now a speaker for AOPA, so you might see him as he gives seminars around the country. So anyway, kind of fun to see that. So yet another resource for people who are learning to fly. You can check that out at flyingmag.com, and it's the May issue.
Great. Also, just today, I received some information about the D-Day squadron and also the DAX over Normandy, and I'll pull all that together for next time. But for now, I'll just mention that the D-Day squadron looks like it's going to be about 16 or so. We'll be assembling at the Waterbury-Oxford Airport May 12th through 19th, 2019, and then they'll depart for Europe to join up with DAX over Normandy May 19th. That's going to prove to be, I think, an interesting departure. I'm planning to be there. I know some of our listeners are also planning to be there. So I'll have a little bit more information about that next episode. If you can't wait till then, I'll probably put some of this in the Slack team or just write to us and ask what's the scoop at this point. All right. And finally, we have a brief recording from our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and he attended a B-29 ground school. So let's listen to Launchpad.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and I'm here at Meacham Field in Fort Worth, Texas, and I'm here with
Jacques Robitaille. I'm the public information officer with the B-29, B-24 squadron.
And the reason we're here is we're here for B-29 ground school. Why are we doing ground school?
Well, Launchpad, we're getting ready to go to start our tour season. So B-29 ground school is our opportunity to re-educate all of our existing scanners and crew members, as well as introduce the new crew members to what they can expect out on the road.
And we're not just going to take the airplane out on tour to show it off like at air shows. People can buy rides on these airplanes.
Absolutely. Our tour stop is typically a week long. We open the plane up for cockpit tours during most of the week. And then we also have ride flights available that we scheduled on the weekends. So customers can come out to the airports and see the planes, get up close and personal, as well as book rides on them.
Well, if our listeners wanted to go for a ride, let's say in the next 2 months, where are you going to be?
Well, the tour stops start in Montgomery, Alabama on the 17th of May. We'll move to Chattanooga, Tennessee on May the 22nd through the 26th. The Tri-Cities area in Tennessee, which is Bristol, Kingsport, and Johnson City, May 29th through June the 2nd. And then on into Salisbury, Maryland, June the 3rd, the 5th. And the big show is in Reading, Pennsylvania, June the 7th, which is their annual World War II Expo.
Cool. So, and to restate, they can buy a ride flight.
Absolutely.
Well, folks, there's something you can do this weekend. Jacques, if they wanted to know more, where would they go?
I'd send them to our website. It's airpowertour.org.
And now you've got something to look forward to. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Thank you, Launchpad. All right, that's it for this episode. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com, of course. And if you want to go to the show notes for this episode, they are at airplanegeeks.com/551. David Vanderhoof, where can folks find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team. And how do you find me there? Well, you send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite, and you can sneak in the back door and hang out with all of the geeky geeks in our Slack listener team and talk about various things, not just general aviation or meetups, but various topics. Feel free, it's a safe space You can talk about everything. You can complain about how bad our performance was last week, you know, that kind of stuff. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, doing that show about drones. This week, I'm sure we will be talking again, and we'll be revisiting that kidney transplant. So it's theuavdigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, this is a good week for listeners to check out the Aviation News Talk podcast if they have not done that recently. You mentioned one of the recent episodes, Eight Lessons Pilots Can Learn from the Boeing 737 MAX Crashes. And I'll just go ahead and tease people and let them know that number eight is know the critical single points of failure in your aircraft. And there are single critical points of failure in general aviation aircraft that people routinely fly. And then the one we just did last week was avoiding deadly VFR and IMC accidents. And that was one of our safety moment episodes with Rob Mark. And so you can check that out any place you get podcasts. Just look for Aviation News Talk, three different words, or go to aviationnewstalk.com and you can find links to it online. And of course, while you're there, all you need to do is click on contact at the top of the page where you can send me an email. Or if you want to record a listener question, which I'll play on the show, you can just click on listener questions.
Cool. Very good. And you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. As David said, at theuavdigest.com. Also, check out that episode I mentioned at paxexpodcast.com. That's paxexpodcast.com. If you want to send me an email, that's maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And happy birthday, me. Happy birthday, Max Flight. Happy birthday, Peter. And happy birthday, Mary. It's Airplane Geek Week for birthdays.
This is.
And of course, thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, we shall...